We are ending our season with a four-week series on the sacraments. Sacraments, sounds like some fancy high church word. Some might even wonder, what are we even talking about when I say the word sacrament? Well, the English word sacrament is a transliteration of the Latin word sacramentum, which means symbol or ritual. And so that's what we're going to be looking at, Christian symbols, rituals. I'll give you a brief little history here. So far as we can tell, Jesus left three sacraments for us: baptism, Eucharist, Lord's table, and washing feet. Now, washing feet, everybody except for certain sects got rid of that. But a brief little history here. 1,200 years into Christianity, he got sacraments, and then Catholic Church started developing lots of nice little rules and, you know, red tape around all that stuff. So right before the Reformation, we actually have seven sacraments the Catholic Church has: baptism, confirmation, Eucharist, penance, marriage, orders, and last anointing. Ah, but then along come Zwingli, Calvin, Luther with their Reformation of protest, and suddenly we're back down to two: baptism and Eucharist. So I want to look at baptism next week, Eucharist, the Lord's table, whatever you want to call it, communion, this morning. And to do that, I would simply want to, what is this thing that we do? I want to ask the question, what is it? On the Jesus path, Eucharist is a ritual, it's a sign, and it's a portal. I want to look at each of those ideas and try to bring some deeper understanding around some of these rituals that we do. So let's start with it as a ritual. Eucharist is a ritual. Now, rituals are so fascinating to me. I love them. But I often shy away from talking about Christian rituals here because they're weird. And that's kind of part and parcel with what rituals are. They're weird. And in my mind, the weirder, the better. But for years, this had me a bit reluctant to talk about them, but I've changed my mind on this recently because rituals were never really a big subject of scientific study. Psychology seemed to skip right over it, but recently, scientist and anthropologist, I'm going to mess up his name, Demetrios Exgalatis, he changed all that, did a landmark study on the history of rituals and what they achieve, and then he sort of took his big study, dumbed it down for folk like me, and put it into his book, Ritual: How Seemingly Senseless Acts Make Life Worth Living. It's a wonderful book. I believe, actually, Melissa Bowman recommended it to me. And in the book, he says this: ritual is a true human universal. Without a single exception, all known human societies, whether past or present, and he offers to give you your money back on the book if you can find one that hasn't, all societies have a range of traditions that involve highly choreographed, formalized, and precisely executed behaviors that mark threshold moments in people's lives. So, first point, Eucharist is a ritual. It's a ritual we perform together, and why? Because it makes a moment matter. We do weird things in order to make moments matter. Consider a number of us were at John Benjamin's concert Friday. That was a swell time. And I walked in with my wife Kristen, my brother Mike, and Josh Hissa, and we sat down and we ordered drinks, and the first thing we did is we lifted up our glasses and we bumped them together. Which all of you are like, yeah, that's what we do. But do you know how weird that is? You sit down like, hey, cheers, clink. It's bizarre. But why? Why do you do that? Because this isn't just sitting down at a table. It's a special evening, special moment. And so we cheers. Or consider my playoff outfit. This is what I wore for every Leaf game in the playoffs. Now, the regular season is 82 games. I didn't put this on then. But for the playoffs, every game I wore my onesie and a cape. And I was able to convince five friends, because we all got superstitious. I had five other grown men convinced they needed to wear a cape too. But, well, Scott, I'm glad you mentioned that, because here's what happened, friends. I wore this every game. Did the Leafs win the first series? Yes, they did. And then, I don't want to throw Kristen under the bus, but I'm going to. After the first series, she washed my onesie. Yeah, you know it. And the flag, all the magic was gone, and the Leafs lost, so you can blame her for that. Or think about birthdays. We get a cake and light it on fire, and then have people blow it out. You know how strange that is? And then we're like, we should get you a present, but I don't want to give it to you. I'm going to wrap it, and then you have to tear it off. So strange. It's such a strange, bizarre ritual. If you had an alien, they'd be like, I don't understand this. Or Thanksgiving. Can we all agree turkey's probably the least good meat? It's not just burgers and coleslaw. It's turkey as an excuse to pour gravy on it because it makes a moment mad, or you get married and you dress up in all these silly clothes and pretend you're having a big party for everyone. Why? Because that's the nature of rituals. We do weird things, weird actions, and why? Because it makes a moment matter. But that's just the beginning of the power of ritual. Exgladius continues, says this: ritual seems pointless, yet what might initially appear bizarre or futile can actually have transformative power. Although ritual actions have no direct influence on the physical world, they can transform our inner world and play a decisive role in shaping our social world. By coming together to enact rituals, practitioners cease to be an assortment of individuals and become a community with shared norms, rules, and values. Rituals, humanity's basic social act. Ooh, I love this. Because sometimes I hear people say, why do we do these weird things? It's just superstition. It doesn't really do anything. And Demetrius gets at it here. You're right. Rituals do not affect the physical world. But that isn't their power. Because this physical material world isn't the only world that exists. They change our inner world and our social world. And so we all have rituals. All of us. It's not a question of are you ritualistic or not. We all have rituals, and they perform three basic functions: to make moments matter, to change our inner world, to change our social world. And that's a part of what Eucharist is. The Jesus Path rituals are no different. They serve the same purpose as every ritual. They exist to make a moment stand out. They exist to change our inner landscape, our social landscape. But then the question becomes, okay, well, what do they make matter? What do they do to our inner world? What do they do to our social world? Well, this brings us to the second feature of sacraments, and that is that they are a sign. They're rituals, but they're also signs. Signs that point us toward something. A good sign points us in a certain direction. I'm sure everyone's following or aware that the whole country, except for Ontario, seems to be on fire. We have wildfires in Nova Scotia, Quebec, out west, and this has had me very interested in a very specific subgenre of narrative nonfiction, and it's books by people who live in lookout towers. It's so fascinating. I can't tell if it's the greatest job in the world or the worst, but this recent one, Lookout by Trina Moyles, Canadian lookout tower person. Oh, so fascinating. They spend months of isolation every day climbing their tower, sitting there scanning the horizon, looking for a sign. Looking for sign of fire. And it's always smoke. Where there's smoke, there's fire. Days and days on end, binocular scanning the horizon, looking for a sign. And fire's perfect sign is smoke. You see smoke, you know there's a fire. Moreover, you know where there is a fire. That's how a good sign functions. It tells you where you're to look and what it's pointing to. And yet, not all signs are created equally. Some signs are bad. They're just bad. I had a lot of fun this week looking up some sign failures. I've got 8 of them here for you. No pets cooking bicycles, that's just a bad sign. What else do we got here? Remember that movie, There Will Be Blood? Apparently there was definitely maybe playing at the same time.
this one makes sense to me a lot. Yep, that actually seems a little too generous. Bring that number down a bit. I have tried every variation of this. I cannot make sense of this sign no matter what order you put it in. I just don't know what they were thinking. Anyway, I think you go to the third floor. Kids with gas eat free. Yes. And then we've got, oh, this one's brutal. Depending on how you read it, yeah. Yeah. Boy, I could use a sign of hope today. You don't matter. Give up. And then, thanks, Home Depot, but I think I can handle this on my own. That one, I don't need your help. And I have no idea who made this sign, but just what? I don't get it. People eating children. I don't know. Is there any more? I forget. That's it. Is that it? That's it. Bad signs. If you're going to make a sign, make a good sign. Augustine once said, if sacraments did not bear some resemblance to the things of which they are the sacraments, they would not be sacraments at all. For Augustine and many others who travel the Jesus path, the symbolism of the sacraments is that they serve as a sign. They point to something important. And I've started to learn this about myself. This is why I can be a bit of a cantankerous curmudgeon around Eucharist. Because I have pastor friends who play very fast and loose with the sign that is Eucharist, and it drives me nuts. One pastor friend's like, hey, our church, we had camp together, went camp together, we had Eucharist on the beach, and we used milk and Oreos. It's like, oh, I wanted to throw up in my mouth. Are you kidding me? Like, what is that a sign of? Parents putting you to bed before? Jeez, I just, or then he said, oh, we've also used orange juice and Ritz, and I'm like, this is brutal to me. Now, if I had my way, I can be a little too much of a curmudgeon. If I had my way, the way we would do Eucharist is this. We'd all have a common goblet, and we'd pass it around and each drink from it. And I know all you germies are like, ah! And for the bread, we'd pass around a single loaf and all get our sweaty hands on it and tear a piece and hand it to the next person. That's how I would love to do it, but I get that that's a bit much for people. But it's like, if you're going to do a sign, make it a good sign. And wine and bread are a good sign. Wine, not juice, because juice is sweet. And what we're doing isn't sweet. That's the thing about red wine, is it's sort of, I don't know my fancy words for red wine except for unctuous, but in general, it's bittersweet. And it's bitter because what we're celebrating is a death, and yet the sweet aspect reminds us that we are celebrating. It looks like blood. Milk or orange juice, are you kidding me? Bread, not crackers, because it's a body broken. And so wine and bread are actually a good sign. They point to something important. When we participate in the Lord's Supper, communion, Eucharist, we celebrate Jesus' bodily sacrifice. My body broken for you. My blood poured out for you. Drink it all. And with the sacramental ritual, the elements and the words we speak around this ritual, they are an important sign. And it becomes impossible for us to ignore death and the weakness of our bodies. I love this quote from Richard Beck. He says, the Eucharist pushes against the Gnostic temptation by keeping the disgusting aspects of the body firmly in view. The Eucharist keeps Christian worship firmly connected to the gritty, oozy realities of the human body. I love it. Because we're scared of death, and we're often ashamed of our bodies. And in this ritual, we're reminded that it was a weak, broken, bloodied body that brings redemption to the world. And so right away, the moment we come to this ritual, we're forced to confront our fear of death, our insecurities about the body, which is a good thing, but that is a sign that points to something beyond it. It's not only a sign declaring that a new world has been born through the cross, it's a sign that points to a portal. There's a way to enter this new world. Eucharist is a portal that bridges the gap between God and ourselves. There's another world that exists beyond the realm of the one we inhabit. There's more to life than the material world. Eucharist is a portal into that world that serves as a physical doorway, a gateway into this world. Augustine called it visible forms of invisible grace. And so what does the Eucharist usher us into? What kind of world? Well, it ushers us into Jesus' kingdom, the Jesus path, resurrection country, you could say. And as part of that, it ushers us into a world of inclusion and embrace. Because we're asked to do this ritual with people who are very different than us. People we probably disagree with. People we might not even like. And standing shoulder to shoulder with people we don't see eye to eye on, it's like Demetrius says, the power of rituals that it changes our inner world, our social world. We are changed internally, and how we see community is changed. I mean, consider the importance of exclusion versus inclusion and embrace in the Corinthian church. 1 Corinthians is such a fascinating letter to me because from all we can gather, this church was a complete mess. And it had a ton of issues going on. The first is they were arguing over leadership. Everyone's like, we like that leader, we don't like that leader. No, I like that leader, don't like that leader. There was a case of incest going on. Some guy sleeping with his father's wife. And it's like, hey, that's what we do. And then there were these factions. There was one group who was like, hey, everybody can have sex with everybody. And they, wouldn't that be great? And then there was another group who was like, you should never have sex ever. Everyone should remain chaste and single. And they're battling it out. And then they were suing each other. They were advocating for, hey, my spiritual gift is better than yours. There's chaos from what we can gather. Chaos in their gatherings. People run around shouting. It was a complete gong show. This community had a ton of problems. And Paul's writing to them, I need to help you maybe get things together here. But of all the things that were going on in Corinthian, the thing that bothered Paul the most was how they were celebrating Eucharist, their table manners. Early Christians would celebrate the Lord's Supper. What they would do is gather for a communal meal, and they didn't have buildings, right? They didn't have churches like we do. And they would assemble on Sundays, but that wasn't a day off of work in the Roman world. And this is where the problem arose, because what would happen is the wealthier people in the church didn't really have to work. And so they had the whole day off to, hey, let's get together, start at noon. But everyone who had to work, people like slaves, people low on the socioeconomic ladder, they had to work 6-7, so they would show up, hey, we're doing this, our church is doing this thing, and all the rich people are hammered. And the food's gone. And there wasn't enough room, so the rich people are meeting in the comfortable inner house, and you've got all these poor people who just worked all day on the outer thing going, is there any chicken wings left for me? No, we ate it all. And it didn't occur to the Corinthian church that this kind of behavior was frowned upon. This was just what you did. Rich and poor, they don't eat together. We don't sit around tables as equals. No, we're divided groups. This is the way things are. But Paul's like, this is a fundamental violation of everything this sign and portal is about. And for the church in Corinth, they struggled with the same thing that we do. Everyone surrounded themselves with people like them. I'm comfortable with this group, so I'm just going to cloister with them. Well, it was a problem then, it's a problem today. But Paul advocated for a radically different vision. This is what he says in 1 Corinthians 11. In the following directives, I have no praise for you, for your meetings do more harm than good. In the first place, I hear that when you come together as a church, there are divisions among you. To some extent, I even believe it. No doubt, there have to be differences among you to show which of you have God's approval. So then, when you come together, it's not the Lord's Supper you eat. For when you're eating, some of you go ahead with your own private suppers. As a result, one person remains hungry, another gets drunk. Don't you have homes to eat and drink in? Or do you despise the church of God by humiliating those who have nothing? What do you want me to say to you? Shall I praise you? Certainly not. So then, Whoever eats the bread or drinks the cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of sinning against the body and blood of the Lord. Everyone ought to examine themselves before they eat of the bread and drink from the cup. For those who eat and drink without discerning the body of Christ eat and drink judgment on themselves. And I know so many of us have been like, oh my goodness, is there any unconfessed sin in my life? I don't want to get judged here. It's not about that. It's about who are you refusing to stand beside at the table. Who are you like, I'll do the ritual, but not if it has to be next to that person. Because that's what Paul's getting at. And you see what's happening here. Some of the people in Corinth are trying to do the ritual. They're trying to do the sign while refusing to enter this portal into a new world. And Paul says the beginning of this ritual starts with inclusion and embrace. In Corinthian church, you've turned it into one of exclusion. How dare you? I mean, I did a worst wedding I ever did. In fact, I think it was the last one. Ended in disaster. Buddy from high school got engaged, met with him and his wife-to-be. Everything seemed fine. Boy, it was a fancy wedding. Chris and I were up top of some tower in Toronto looking out. It was just awesome. They stood before me, made their vows. You, you only, blah, all that, blah, blah, blah. All that stuff. And then my brother says, 3 months later, hey, they are separated and getting divorced. And listen, I get it. There's a ton of reasons why marriages fall apart, but 3 months? The first thought was, can I get my gift back? Because, like, I mean, there should be a return policy. See, if we don't make it past 6 months, you get your gift back. I don't know. But it just felt like this thing that we did, that we participated in, and then to throw it away in 3 months. And I think this is what Paul's getting at. There's this thing, this new world, this sign, this portal, and it's maybe started well, but you've turned it into something so awful. And Paul's mindset seems to be the Eucharist is about coming together under the banner of Jesus' death, believing his death is a portal into a new world, a new way of living and being. His death on the cross gives us access to God's realm, God's kingdom, God's way of life. And on that path, there are to be no divisions or boundaries among us. Because what the Eucharist says is this, no matter what boundaries exist between us, beliefs, social class, race, whatever it is, whatever differences, at the table, we stand shoulder to shoulder. We eat and we drink together in honor of Jesus, because that's the kind of radical hospitality we see Jesus modeling. And so the Eucharist takes us into a world where we're forced to confront our fear of death, insecurities about our body. It's about breaking down boundaries and barriers, but it's also about purity. And that's a loaded word these days, a lot of baggage with the word purity. And for some of us in our traditions, we were reminded in the church that if we did certain things or made certain mistakes, we were impure. And the irony of it all to me is that this ritual is a portal into a new world and reality where we're all clean. Eucharist is a celebration of our future identity. Because Jesus died, our impurities, real or perceived, are gone. The debts of guilt and shame we carry no longer need to carry. In 1 Corinthians 6, Paul says this, you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of God. Why do we do this regularly at Nexus? It's simple. Because some of us need to be reminded again and again and again and again that the things we're ashamed of, the things we feel dirty and unclean about, are taken care of. You can live free from that. You can let it go. You don't need to live under the weight of that baggage any longer. And so it's a portal into a new world. The last portal is it takes us into a new world where we're forced, I think, to confront our fear of community. You know, for Paul, one of the marks of a person who had entered the Jesus path, the new world of the Jesus path, was their ability to operate in a community centered around the person of Jesus. When we dip the bread in the cup, we are saying we belong together. We are equals striving to walk the Jesus path together, all of us in need of grace. It's about community, but community makes us uncomfortable. It's way easier to be spiritual but not religious. Community is tough. Henry Nouwen really hits this well. Community is the place where the person you least want to live with always lives. Community has little to do with mutual compatibility. Similarities in educational background, psychological makeup, social status can bring us together, but they can never be the basis for community. Community is grounded in God who calls us together, not in the attractiveness of people to each other. There are many groups that have been formed to protect their own causes, but none of these are Christian community. Instead of breaking through the walls of fear and creating new space for God, they close themselves to real or imaginary intruders. The mystery of community is precisely that it embraces all people, whatever their individual differences may be, and allows them to live together as brothers and sisters of Christ and sons and daughters of his heavenly Father. One of the biggest mistakes Christian faith has made over the past 50 to 100 years has been the emphasis on Jesus' work on the cross as an individual thing. Far too many people think the Jesus path is about me and God, but it's not. Or it's more than that. You know, this week I was driving, I had a meeting. And I see a car up ahead of me that's got a sign on the back of it. And when I realize what the sign was, I'm like, I just have to follow them. So I followed them, and I was a little bit late for my meeting. We ended up in Costco parking lot. And finally they parked because I wanted to be safe. I wanted to get a safe picture. And there, I got it right here. Jesus saves, this is your sign. Then I had to scurry away because they were getting out there. And I didn't really want to talk to them. Costco people, I'm one of them, but they can be unpredictable, you know. But I had to get a picture of this because I was, Jesus saves. Absolutely, I believe it. That's your sign? Like, what, that morning you're like, I know, if I get a piece of Bristol board, write it down, stick it to the back of my Jeep. I'm like, oh, that's a bad sign, a horrible sign. And I wanted to chat with them, but again, I kept going. But what I desperately wanted to say to those people was, Jesus saves, absolutely, but no, that sign's not helping. That's a bad sign. The sign that Jesus saves is right here, here at the Eucharist table, shoulder to shoulder. People very different from one another, standing around a table, dipping bread into wine. That's the sign. The cross was about so much more than reconciling humans to God. It was about reconciling people to people. And the first Christians struggled with how to really live out this idea of community. We do as well. Truth is, we're very fickle about community, right? We love it when it's going our way and sort of feels good to us. We're eager about it. But when community gets tough, and it always does, when it requires sacrifice, perseverance, hard work, listening to that person who you've already explained their position that you totally disagree with again, all of that stuff, when it gets hard, oh, it's easy to go, you know what? I like the spiritual but not religious category better. Because then I can just sit at home. I don't have to deal with people I don't like. And when that happens, we retreat into groups of people just like us. You know, the Eucharist is an invitation to many things, but at its core, it's an invitation into a portal into a different world, a portal where commitment and community trump choice and comfort. To stand shoulder to shoulder in true community also means that we enter into a portal world where the Eucharist invites us into a world where we give up our right to be right. And simply put, Jesus tells us it's more important to be in community and stand shoulder to shoulder with each other than to be right. And that's the way of love, and that is the key to overcoming boundaries. And to me, it's an important challenge because we simply fight and disagree with each other about way too many things. And all of us, I get it, all of us have our hard, fast, non-negotiables. I cannot compromise on this thing at any cost. I get it. But what this ritual says here in this place is, I don't always have to be right. And while that might be non-negotiable for me, I'm willing to stand around a table with people who I might disagree with because Jesus' work on the cross has opened the gateway to a different world. And too often what's at stake is more our pride than truth, more the need to be right than the need for truth. Eucharist invites us into a world where it's more important to get over the boundaries that separate us than it is to be comfortable. I'm going to ask the band to come and close with this song. We'll lay off the Bruce Coburn, but he's got a new album out. And when I first heard this song, I said to Dave, we have to do this song. And I love it because only Bruce Coburn can get away with calling it Orders. And I'll let the song speak for itself, but as we move into Eucharist, we remind ourselves it's a ritual, and it's a weird one, and we don't have to be embarrassed about that because rituals are weird, and everybody does them, and this is one of ours. And so we come and dip the bread in the wine, and we'll hear the words, Christ's body broken for you, Christ's blood shed for you, and in that we are given a sign showing us that in Jesus giving his life by his body being broken and drained, a new world was born, a world redeemed and made new. But in taking the elements, we're also invited into a portal to enter this new world and to walk its path, where there's no boundaries or divisions, where we don't need to worry about our failures or shame, where we are asked to stand in community. We're invited to enter a new world where, as Richard Beck says, we come into community as real people, divided in the larger world into a sweaty, intimate, flesh and blood embrace where there shall be no difference between them and the rest. As this song tells us, that's not the Jesus path suggestion. It's our orders. Dave? Dave?